On this episode of Skeptico.
I want to read, folks, so they don't think I'm sandbagging you. The question I wrote you, I said, are your students rioting against the university's secular humanist demanding recognition of soul and spirit? Are they protesting against atheistic feminism? I said, I'm kidding, of course, but you get the point. The central issue relative to the intersection of consciousness and politics seems to have been swallowed in shallow thinking ocean of not my president identity politics. I mean, the issue here is that we are more than biological robots in a meaningless universe. We have a spirit. We have a soul. So why not go join arms with your local seminary students and go march on Berkeley? That's really the battle here. And it mystifies me how folks in your camp, of which I am part of, do not see the divide. The real divide is between atheistic materialism, which is the underlying dogma of science, and kind of creative spiritualism, which is, I think, what your whole program is really all about. Haven't we misidentified the real cause of the friction here?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I guess, Alex, you know, people are going to be where they're going to be in their own conscious evolution. If people are, you know, in an atheistic world, my sense is they're probably suffering from that, even though they may be gloating from that. So, you know, I guess my question to you is, why are you bothered by those people?
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Akaris, and this week, a listener-suggested guest, and I think a pretty good one, Dr. Karen Janke, heads up a program on consciousness at JFK University. So there's really two topics I sought to explore in my interview with Karen, and she did a fabulous job. I really appreciate her coming on and talking about them, because they were both kind of pushing a little bit, but I think she does a great job of putting forth a new and different perspective. And those two issues are, one, consciousness from a transpersonal philosophy, spiritual perspective, that is kind of doing an end run on the scientific neuroscience debate about consciousness. Can we take that path? Where does that path lead? What are the issues surrounding that kind of expansion of consciousness without ever really defining what consciousness is, kind of thing. So that's number one. And the second issue is, since JFK University, her university, is very outwardly socially oriented, what is the intersection between consciousness and politics? And in particular, this expanded view of consciousness and politics. How does that play out? How might our understanding of this idea of consciousness inform right action? So those are the two topics that I wanted to talk about, and I did, with our guest this week, Dr. Karen Janke. I hope you enjoy the interview. Today we welcome Karen Janke to Skeptico. Dr. Janke is chair of the Consciousness and Transformative Studies Program at John F. Kennedy University in the San Francisco Bay Area, a program whose mission is to explore and expand consciousness and human potential, and to foster conscious leadership in service of personnel, organizational, cultural, and ecological change. So, Karen, with that introduction and a very great, interesting mission statement, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. You were recommended to me by a listener, and I thought it would be a good fit since the main focus of our show is consciousness science. But then, you know, I started digging into more of what you're doing up there at the very interesting JFK University. And we kind of exchanged some emails back, and I said, hey, what are you talking about with this consciousness thing? You seem to be coming at it from a different direction. So as we were just chatting about, you know, I poked at you a little bit in my emails, and you, in some very appropriate, interesting, intelligent ways, kind of poked back at me. So I think we're going to have a good chat. And I want to talk about JFK University. I want to talk about the program, the very interesting program you have going on there. But let me start with this. Karen, what is consciousness? What do you understand, and what is your working definition of what consciousness is?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that question, because that term gets thrown around in so many different ways in everyday language. And I think, you know, if you start mixing up different understandings of consciousness, then, of course, you have a mixed up conversation from the start. So, I mean, I think some people speak about consciousness as mind in general, referring to the mental process involving all organizations. And some people speak about it as the reflective consciousness that human beings have, and which is, you know, generally considered to be a higher order of consciousness. So I think we have to be really clear about which definition we're using or which aspect of consciousness we're looking at. I mean, in an everyday sense, you could say consciousness refers to sentience or awareness. Those are, and sometimes it's, you know, referred to as mind as opposed to matter. To me, one of the clarifying ways to think about consciousness is to draw on living systems theory. And basically, living systems theory says that mind is present at all levels of matter. In other words, what every system in the universe does, from the particle to the universe as a whole, is process information and process and exchange energy. And so that information processing function that's present in, you know, even in particles, you could think of as the beginning of a kind of consciousness. You could use information processing as a definition of consciousness, that we're taking in information from the world, processing it, and that is guiding our interactions with the world. So if you speak about consciousness in that way as kind of a, you know, and then, I mean, I think we have to allow that there's a spectrum of consciousness at more sophisticated levels, you know, presumably going up to human beings, at least those we credit ourselves with having the highest forms of consciousness, so which we can question some of that too, from a systems perspective of we're the only species on the planet that has ever, you know, systematically destroyed its own environment.
Okay, but hold on. Before we get off into kind of too far into the social issues and any even ecological issues, which I kind of understand where you're going there, but you can see where the line gets a little bit fuzzy. I mean, let's bring it back into focus with some of the questions that you were just asking there. Is consciousness an epiphenomenon of the brain? And this is something we were just chatting about a second ago, because I was saying, you know, Karen, it kind of seems like you're doing an end run on neuroscience. I mean, if we go over and ask a neuroscientist, like I have many times on this show, is consciousness created by the brain? They emphatically say yes. Consciousness is a product of the brain. When the brain ceases to, human consciousness, when the human brain ceases to function, consciousness is no longer there. What is your take on that?
Well, I mean, I definitely think that there is an association of consciousness with the brain, at least a human form of consciousness. I mean, again, I want to open up the door that consciousness as information processing, as processing and organizing life, exists at all levels of all systems, not just human systems. But then when you want to speak about self-reflective consciousness, the kind of consciousness that seemingly human beings alone possess, i.e. a consciousness that can reflect on itself, that can witness itself, can observe itself.
Can I just interject here with the definition? So let's say working definition, whether we agree with it or not, one is that consciousness is us being aware, or any being being aware that they are aware. So
that self-reflective there. And I don't know that we need to limit that. I mean, it's a big open question, as you alluded to. Is my cat conscious at some level? Is my cat somewhat, in some way, conscious that it is a sentient being? And they do all these, they've done all these experiments, right? A lot of them you've seen about with the mirror, you know, and they put the ape in front of the mirror. And does the ape realize that the reflection is not them? And, you know, there's all this evidence. Yeah, they do. And these are conscious beings and all that stuff is on the table. But another way of kind of asking this is, what is necessary and sufficient for consciousness?
Okay, so and it sounds like you're meaning self-reflective consciousness.
Well, I think that when you talk about, and we'll talk about your program in a minute, but you're talking about, you know, the parallels with philosophy, psychology, and religion and spirituality. When those people are talking about consciousness, when those people, I mean, those disciplines, that's what they're talking about for the most part, is this self-reflective consciousness, this being aware that we are, you know, we are here. There is something in us. There is a voice inside the machine that we can hear.
Right. So, I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, that is probably an attribute of human beings. It does seem that, you know, a complex nervous system and brain is part of what facilitates that higher order consciousness. The living systems theorists would say that consciousness is an emergent property of the brain. And if you understand what they mean by emergent property, I mean, it's like water is an emergent property. The properties of water emerge from the union of hydrogen and oxygen. Neither hydrogen nor oxygen have the same properties that water has. And so you get this, you know, in systems theory, which I'll defend here. I mean, it is the, I would say it's replacing physics as the mother of all sciences, because it's able to integrate across disciplines, across biology, across neuroscience, physics, chemistry. It has a wider explanatory power than any of the specific disciplines that we've all grown up with. And so in living systems theory, you know, there comes a point where you have this this leap. It's like a quantum leap to a new emergent property arises from a certain level of complexity. And
yeah, I mean, I we kind of explored that. I don't know. I got to kind of call BS on that a little bit. I mean, I think the way that the emergent property principle works more in our natural world is like my friend Bernardo Kastrup says, is that a whirlpool is an emergent property of water. But there really is no whirlpool per se when you get down, and we can model it and we can show how it forms. But at the end of the day, there's nothing there. It is just water. I mean, the chemical transformation between water and the molecules, I think, is different. But the problem with the emergent property of the brain thing is, I think we're just kind of on a backslide from where we were 30 or 40 years ago, which was that consciousness is an illusion. There is no real consciousness. It's just our illusion that we are conscious, famously proposed by philosopher Daniel Dennett. But what I'd say, you know, the problem with the emergent property of the brain thing is, just look at the near-death experience science and all the evidence that consciousness in some way we don't understand survives bodily death. So if consciousness survives bodily death, then the emergent property of the brain thing is kind of out the window. Have you, this may be a little bit far outside of your field, but I guess that's my point and can kind of come to you, is I don't think it is. I think until we kind of wrestle these things to the ground, we don't really know where we stand.
Yeah, I mean, the near-death experience, you know, I'm certainly familiar with that literature and have had transcendent experiences, not near-death experiences, not associated with an experience of death. I mean, there is a mystery there about how much consciousness transcends you know, bodily processes.
Maybe let's get off of this track for a second and talk a little bit more about you and your background, because I think what you just alluded to in terms of spiritually transformative experiences fit very well into what we might consider in terms of near-death experience science. So let me back all the way back up, because you have a really interesting background, seminary student at Princeton, who then kind of goes through somewhat of a transformation of your own. So please tell us that story.
Okay. That's a good place to begin, because I think it really grounds where I've gone with this field of study. It very much comes out of my own life experiences. And I guess this is part of my problem with trying to discuss consciousness in abstract terms that are devoid of the biography of the discussant. I think that's where you get into some problematic territory. So you alluded to being in my experience in seminary. I was a spiritual seeker from early on, and in my last year of seminary, and a couple years after I finished seminary, I worked as a prison chaplain. And I was working, actually, it was in the late 80s. I was working with people with AIDS. I was assigned to an AIDS unit, and this was in the state of New Jersey. There was no cure for AIDS. And in addition to that, I was going to visit the sole woman on death row in the state of New Jersey at the request of the administrator of the prison. So I was, you know, about 30 years old, and I was just completely immersed in death. Death of people my age, you know, the kind of hovering death of death row and the all of those experiences. And I found that I did not have the inner resources to cope with it. And so I started in a therapy. I went to see a Jungian analyst, and Jungians are sort of famous for asking about your dreams. And I had not really paid attention to my dream life up until that time. But I started tracking my dreams and remembering them. And I would bring, you know, the biggest, most jarring, puzzling, upsetting, challenging dreams that I had to my therapist. And I worked in this way for about 5.5 years, really mining my own consciousness and being willing to engage with whatever came up from the dream world, which of course the ego has very little control over. All you have to do is try to dictate what dream you're going to have, and you can see how impossible that is. But I realized early on that the dreams had a much more complex and nuanced and emotionally laden story about my life than I was telling myself out of kind of my suburban, middle-class storyline. And that actually is what then got me to graduate school. And in graduate school, another occurrence happened, I guess around the same time. I started having migraine headaches, and they were completely debilitating. They were chronic, you know, so it wasn't something I could ignore. My thought was, you know, wow, my body is doing something really dramatic here. What is this about? Why am I suddenly, you know, basically being hammered over the head with a migraine? And in graduate school, I was very fortunate to study with Stanislav Grof, who has done quite a bit of work around birth trauma. He's a psychiatrist, so he understood, he'd been to medical school and understood the biological phases of birth, and did some research tying the biological phases of birth to the psychological phases of birth. And in his work, he says that migraine headaches are one symptom of birth trauma. So I got interested in that question. Is that what's going on here? And started doing some research, started trying to work with the migraines consciously. I did not take drugs for them, except, I mean, occasionally I would take Advil if it was just, you know, I had to function in some way. But I really tried to explore what was going on in my own body and my own consciousness with these migraine headaches. And eventually I was able to track them back to the beginning basically once a migraine gets going, it's very hard to reverse it. So I had to learn what were the kind of precursor signs to a migraine. And eventually I was able to heal myself of the migraines by tracking them, by really just being very curious about this, you know, kind of violent process in my head. And so that experience and then piecing together my birth trauma, you know, I can really say that the jolt of my birth trauma is what put me on a consciousness path. All the way, really, before I even got out of the womb, my consciousness was disturbed. And of course, you know, I coped with it as a child, but then as soon as I became an adult, it was screaming for my attention, this history. So I'm very aware that, you know, of the role of trauma and life story in shaping our consciousness. And what happened for me basically was that my own consciousness was a problem to me. You know, it was creating incredible suffering. And so my exploration of consciousness is less about the sort of abstract questions and more about the immediacy of my own experience and how can I live in this body with this, you know, traumatized head. And in my research, you know, back into my own birth story and early childhood, I realized that I'd had like 5 head traumas by the time I was bike riding age. So, you know, all of that jarring of my head required that I work with my own consciousness in a way to heal those, you know, traumatic disturbances, you might say. And my dreams, of course, were, you know, primary help in that process. Meditation has been a help in that process. I guess those are, you know, and so I've also done some yoga over at times, integrating, you know, mind and body practices.
Okay. So there's, you know, that's cool. And I'm all for that. And, you know, especially on a personal level, I'm still a little bit struggling with how that fits within an academic, academia, scientific kind of basis. And I know you're kind of on the edges there with transpersonal psychology and all the rest of that. But I do feel a need to kind of keep wrestling it down to the ground. You know, I sent you a link in the emails that we had to the Consciousness Conference at the University of Arizona, which is probably one of the more well-known in this very small kind of fringy field of consciousness studies. And there's no overlap to anything you're saying, right? So those people would know Stanislav Grof and his interesting work with psychedelics and then with dream work and breathing work and all the rest of that. But for the most part, these people in the consciousness studies thing, no matter how fringy they are trying to map it back to more of a model that fits into science. So as I said at the beginning, can we really do an end run on the whole science thing? I mean, if you go talk to an academic and told them that the jolt of your birth trauma disturbed your consciousness, I mean, I don't know where they'd go with that.
Yeah, I mean, I understand people explore consciousness, you know, what I would say, from a disembodied place. If you explore consciousness simply as an abstract concept and aren't looking at, you know, the very thing we were talking about at the beginning, the self-aware part of it, where does one's self-awareness come into that? Why are those the questions that are interesting? That you're looking for is the shift, and I would say the program that I teach in embraces this shift. It's not that we're not interested in the principles, concepts and principles of science, but how does one's own consciousness dictate the very questions that are being asked. And, you know, I think our program, that title, Consciousness and Transformative Studies, the transformative part of it actually refers to the self-work that students do in the program. So we're interested in the process of transformation of people's own consciousness. And what does that look like? What does it mean to develop one's own consciousness? Where is that question on the table? And, you know, what kinds of questions emerge about consciousness from different levels of consciousness? What does it mean to develop your own consciousness? And I think we would say, you know, some of it is skills of self-observation. Some of it has to do with integration. So integration of the fragmented parts of one's own consciousness. What does it mean to discipline one's consciousness, to have a disciplined consciousness? What does it mean to unify one's consciousness so that one's not experiencing or viewing the world from a polarized place? So the transformative part of our program that's in the title of the program is basically asking the student that comes there to make their own consciousness an object of investigation. And I think the leading edge of consciousness studies is going to be to work with first-person experiences, because the only consciousness we can directly observe is our own. And so our own consciousness is really, you know, I think a starting place for the investigation of consciousness. If you skip over that, then you end up in all of these, you know, I think dead-end alleys. You end up, you know, with making metaphysical assumptions about consciousness that are not grounded in your own experience. So we, you know, we take very seriously the kind of first-person science. And, you know, most of conventional science isn't willing to go there. And I think this speaks to a bigger problem about the relationship between objectivity and subjectivity. So if you pretend that subjectivity is not present at every moment, i.e. subjectivity is consciousness, the researcher's own consciousness is present at all times. And to not account for that in an investigation is a distortion.
Well, I agree with you completely. But I mean, to me, that kind of gets back to the original question. So if we're operating under a paradigm that says consciousness is an illusion, so therefore experience is fundamentally an illusion, but I never think we make that explicit. So I see where you're coming from, and I totally get that. We have to reintroduce first-person experience. But what about some kind of balance? You know, I just did interview not too long ago Dr. Jeffrey Long, who I always kind of my go-to guy. He's a oncologist who got really interested in studying near-death experience and has collected the largest database of near-death experiences. So now he has first-person experiences. And for the super scientific-minded, I always point out that, you know, if you go out and do a medical survey on pain, if you go out and do a medical survey on depression, which are the building blocks for all the pharmacological solutions we have for that, well, that's all first-person experience. You're saying, well, how did you feel? How did you feel this morning? How did you feel after you took this medication? That's first-person experience. So that is a part of science, and we do have a way of handling it. But I digress slightly, because what Jeff has done is taken spiritually transformative experiences. That's what these people have when they have these near-death experiences. They're spiritually transforming. And then he's tried to look systematically at that. And I think that rigor is important. And that's, I guess, one thing that I guess I'm looking for here a little bit when we say, you know, hey, everyone's first-person experience matters. Well, I don't know. Don't we have to be a little more systematic than that?
Absolutely. No, absolutely, Alex. You're totally right. I mean, we have to add some other things into the mix with first-person experience. One is, you know, what I was mentioning earlier, what The Buddhists would tell us that an undisciplined consciousness is an unreliable, observer of truth. And this is where what I was saying earlier about what does it mean to develop one's own consciousness, to develop one's own powers of self-observation, and part of what we teach students in the program is they learn multiple lenses, from affect theory and emotional intelligence to, psychological schemas to Buddhist, or meditation practices. In other words, we learn many ways of observing ourselves. We have many lenses for observing ourselves as well as practices. So, you need a disciplined consciousness to be able to observe, accurately what's happening within your own consciousness. Then I think you can, the consensus validation of science does not have to be thrown out the window. You can have multiple reports of similar experiences from different people. So if you gathered enough first-person data on similar experiences, then you have something wider to reference. And then thirdly, you can bring and I think this is where the cutting edge of consciousness research needs to go, is you can bring neuroscience, into the mix by trying to look at what is happening in the brain when certain types of experiences are happening. And this has been done, this is how we came to understand in the dream studies world. The sleep cycle in the 1950s was a combination of hooking people up to machines and seeing what was happening in their brains and waking them up and getting a self-report of what was going on in their consciousness. That, I think, is that's where the future is headed, is to, as we develop more instrumentation to do the neuroscience research, we can start to combine first-person experience from reliable reporters, people who've trained their consciousness, with the neuroscience, and get, burrow in on this question of what is the relationship between the brain mechanisms and experience. And I think that's what that's where your interest is how do we tie, we don't want to, from my perspective, I'm not willing to throw out my own experience. Science needs to accommodate, a study of consciousness needs to accommodate a study of experience. And that doesn't mean we throw out the neuroscience piece. I think those self-reports have to be coordinated with, processes to understand what's going on in the brain at the same time. And then we can get closer to this kind of mystery place of how these two, are related to each other.
Great stuff. Let's talk about the other topic I wanted to kind of bring up, was consciousness and politics, because in your very nicely done mission statement that I read earlier, you reference organizational, cultural, and ecological levels of consciousness. I think that's a very, very tricky transition to make, but let's also understand that John F. Kennedy University, as you say, and I've come to know through researching you, that's kind of cooked into the DNA of the university to be socially conscious and to be proactively socially active. So, one, let's talk about how we make that transition. What is, what is right action in that way? And then I'll come back later and talk specifically about some of the problems I see with consciousness in politics.
Yes, so I mentioned in one of our email exchanges the theory of spiral dynamics, and I know Ken Wilber has appropriated that theory, but it's actually not his original theory. It goes back to a guy named Claire Graves, who was doing developmental research, and this, again, is the question about what does it mean to develop our consciousness, both individually and collectively, and I think that's a question that gets left out in some of these mainstream science questions. What does it mean to develop one's own consciousness? And then what does it mean for a culture to develop its own, or an organization to develop its own consciousness? And that's where Claire Graves went. And then Don Beck carried on his research along with Christopher Cohen. Those are really the three main people. Ken Wilber appropriated systems spiral dynamics into his own theory. He's a great, you know, synthesizer and loses some things in the process.
Oh, but a very important, interesting guy. Please go ahead.
Well, so we, you know, after the 2016 election, so many people in my circles were, you know, shocked, disturbed, stunned at what had happened. And, you know, I think a lot of liberal California felt that way and maybe other parts of the country. And so, you know, when you look for explanations about how did this election happen the way it did and what were the, you know, the parts that were involved that allowed Donald Trump to be elected, I think spiral dynamics has some power to illuminate a very, you know, confusing situation. And basically, in spiral dynamics, the different colors are used to code different levels of development. And each level of development in both at the individual level and at the cultural level encompasses the prior levels of development. So, and there's an overall movement toward accommodating greater complexity. So in the spiral dynamics model, you know, most conservatives would be at blue, what they call blue and orange, blue being kind of an authoritarian. And I should just back up and say each of these colors are associated with primary values and worldview. And there are differentiations as you go through them. So blue is, you know, tends to be authoritarian and very loyal to truth, defined by social groupings. It leads people to obey authority. And then you have orange, which is entrepreneurial. It's the entrepreneurial spirit and has a personal success orientation, people calculating their personal advantage. So most people would say the Republican Party is, you know, kind of a combination of blue and orange. And then you have green, which is obviously, you know, focused on environmental issues. It's humanistic. It's interested in personal growth and community. Everyone has a voice. It's very egalitarian. And so most liberals tend to be at orange or green. And then you have yellow is the first level that takes into account systems thinking and holistic thinking. And this is what we don't see a lot of in our country. So this tendency of the parties to polarize against each other is part of what in the model is called first tier consciousness, which is anytime we polarize with the other, we're still in first tier consciousness. Only when you make that leap to yellow and then beyond yellow is turquoise, do you get an ability to think systemically and to take into account all of the voices.
Yeah, but Karen, without getting into politics and kind of staying on the consciousness level, the thing that gets me is there's a total mismatch. These are secular humanists. These are atheists for the most part who are cooking up these ideas. And that's the mismatch with all the other stuff we're talking about. I want to read, folks, so they don't think I'm sandbagging you, the question I wrote you. I said, are your students rioting against the university's secular humanists demanding recognition of soul and spirit? Are they protesting against atheistic feminism? I said, I'm kidding, of course, but you get the point. The central issue relative to the intersection of consciousness and politics seems to have been swallowed in shallow thinking ocean of not my president identity politics. I mean, the issue here is that we are more. We are more than biological robots in a meaningless universe. We have a spirit. We have a soul. So why not go join arms with your local seminary students and go march on Berkeley? That's really the battle here. And it just, it mystifies me how folks in in your camp, of which I am part of, do not see the divide. The real divide is between atheistic materialism, which is the underlying dogma of science, and kind of creative spiritualism, which is, I think, what your whole program is really all about. Haven't we misidentified the real cause of the friction here?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I guess, Alex, you know, I'm not as, I mean, people are going to be where they're going to be in their own conscious evolution. If people are, you know, in an atheistic world, my sense is they're probably suffering from that, even, you know, even though they may be gloating from that. So, you know, I mean, I guess my question to you is, why are you bothered by those people?
For the same reason that, you know, like we're talking about, and we found, you know, kind of a bond or a similar thinking in terms of how we move things forward, how we, you know, we all go through our own transformation, and then we want to talk to other people who are at some point in that journey, right? So in talking about that spiritually transformative experience journey, to me, the big stumbling block for me and for a lot of people was overcoming this ingrained dogma that you are nothing. This is what science teaches us. I mean, I have four kids. Three of them are still in high school. One of them just graduated college. I mean, this is what they're indoctrinated with throughout, is that the universe is meaningless. You are therefore meaningless. You are a biological robot. And now we can play all these nice little games, but none of it is really real. And we're not religious people, so we can't really go down that route. And that has all its own problems. So where are we left? And then we turn, and these are our allies? These secular humanists, atheists? I don't think so. I find more comfort in talking to progressive Christians or Buddhists or people who are at least in the game in terms of thinking about what that more is.
Mm-hmm. I mean, my experience is that the people who adopt a meaningless view of life and the universe suffer for that. That does not come without a price tag. Again, you know, I'm referring it back to their own consciousness. From my perspective, that's a very contracted way to live. And, you know, but if people choose to live in that contracted, you know, form, I mean, I'm going to allow them to do that, you know, and I'm going to do my own thing. My own thing happens to be about expansion of consciousness and obviously meaning, you know, deep meaning in every facet of life. I think we can look at the limitations of someone adopting a meaningless view, that kind of cynical view. If someone wants to go through life that way, you know, I'm not going to stop them, but I'm not going to join them either.
But you are going to offer an alternative. So let's talk a little bit more about, because we haven't really talked about JFK University. Tell us specifically what's going on there and what people are going to find in this program. Is it just a master's degree program, or do you also offer a PhD program in?
We don't. It's just a master's degree. Mm-hmm. We're in some conversations about a potential future PhD, you know, in this area. And I think, you know, one of the areas that we might go into is leadership. Actually, you know, what you find is that if someone cultivates their own consciousness, integrates, does the things I was mentioning, integrates, disciplines, unifies their own consciousness then becomes a force for, you know, you might say good in the world for positive change in the world. And this is, you know, part of what the program is interested in doing. We're interested in turning out people, as you saw in our mission statement. Consciousness in action is a phrase that we use because we want people to spend quite a bit of time investigating their own consciousness, working out the problems in their own consciousness, the conflicts, the shadows, the hidden parts. You know, the black holes. I was talking earlier about my own trauma and the way trauma basically creates a black hole in consciousness. It creates a kind of contracted, you know, contracted response to life. And, you know, from my perspective, some of these naysayer people that you're talking about are caught in a contraction, you know, a contraction of their own consciousness that is not an enviable place to live. So, and most of the students who are drawn to this program have had some kind of jarring, you know, experience to their own consciousness. But that has what, and I think you'll find that's what tends to wake people up to, you know, even an investigation of the topic of consciousness and their own consciousness is you know, similar in a way, similar to my story. It is not always a negative experience. We had a student a few years ago who had a huge dream where he was floating above the universe. This might be similar to a near-death experience, floating above the universe or in some spatial, extended spatial area, and got the communication, experienced that, and I think heard a voice that said, love is all there is. And very, you know, and felt this power of love, you know, coursing through his being in conjunction with this dream. And so, you know, you can have the traumatic experience at the negative end of the spectrum, or you can have a beautiful opening that shows you some, you know, other vision of reality than the dominant paradigm, this meaningless paradigm that you're referencing. And so what does a person do with an experience like that? You know, it's if you attempt to go back to your normal reality after you have a spiritual awakening or a revelation or an invitation, whatever you want to call that, then you're going to be in probably pretty sorry shape. You try to bottle that up and package it back up. And so what happens for people is that they want to take that experience and in a way make it the center of their life. That's what these near-death type experiences do. They have this compelling quality that don't want to be put back in a box. It's you're shown a greater reality, and the challenge then is to live into that greater reality and I would say to bring that greater reality back out in the world, to make a difference in the world. What has that revelatory experience shown you that can make life on the planet better for other people and other beings? And so most of our students have had something like this. In some cases, it's trauma. In some cases, it's, you know, a sort of an enlightenment type of experience. And then they do not want to go back to an ordinary job and back to dominant paradigm thinking. And so they come to this program looking to integrate that experience. I would say to take that experience from being a private experience and make it part of their public identity, make it part of who they come to be known as in their profession and in the world. And that's the common trajectory of the students that are drawn to this program.
Great stuff. So our guest again has been Dr. Karen Jahnke. You can find her at jfk.edu. Great domain there, great URL. It's been great having you on, Karen, and I really appreciate a lot of good stuff was shared here. So great job. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alex.
Okay, Karen.
Yes.
Good, right? It was all good?
Yeah. Are you okay with it?
Yeah. I think it was good, and I do appreciate it, and hopefully we can get some people checking out what you're doing. I love your summation there at the end. I thought that was beautiful. About, you know, I love the point about making it we want to make that the central focus of our life. And you're trying to find people a way to just, one, integrate that internally and then express it out to the world. Awesome stuff.
Good. All right. So will you send me the link or how what happens next?
Of course. Yes. I'll send you the link. It'll be, I'm a little bit backlogged, so it might be 4 weeks or so.
Okay.
I'll send you that link. We'll also do a YouTube on it. And then, you know, you can share it anywhere you like, but I'll just try and get it out as best I can.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks again to Dr. Karen Jahnke for joining me today on Skeptico. I guess the one question I tee up from this interview is from the opening clip.
Have those within academia, particularly the transpersonal psychology types, have they misidentified the target of their political rage? So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Of course, the place to do it is through the Skeptico website, where you can jump on over to the forum and leave a comment there. We've had a steady stream of new forum members, which is always fun, getting some new voices into the conversation. So if you want to become one of those, please visit the Skeptico forum and join. Of course, it's free, as are all the shows, which you can download from the website. You can also connect with me on various ways. Send me an email. People do that all the time. I usually respond, often very quickly, but if not, within a few days. So please, if you feel inclined, reach out and connect. I have a number of interesting shows coming up on Skeptico, a lot of fun stuff to talk about. I do hope you stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.